Leadership, rewards, culture, recruitment. Lifting your company up and staying there is no simple matter. Let Korn Ferry help sync your talent to your strategy to release the full power and potential of your people. Learn more at kornferry.com/up.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green. I'm talking today with Harvard Business School professor Gary Pisano. His new book, which he wrote with HBS professor Willie Shih, is called Producing Prosperity: Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
Sarah, great to be here.
So Gary, I think what I find appealing about the angle you take in the book is about how manufacturing is how you tie it to innovation, because that isn't so much a partisan argument as it is a very practical one. So tell us about the connection you see there.
Well, I think what is often unrecognized is that in the course of innovating new products, there's often an awful lot of innovation of the manufacturing technology, the process technologies that go into making it. And what we tried to draw attention to is the fact that if a country loses its capabilities for manufacturing, with that can go a lot of capabilities for innovation. And it's something that I had been observing for years in my career in looking at industries like biotechnology and others, where, you know, the idea that you do the R&D in one place and it's a compartmentalized activity and you just send it, you know, the technology over the wall to manufacturing somewhere else and there's no interaction. And that's pretty rare. There's a lot of interaction between R&D and manufacturing in the innovation process.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how this connection began to dawn on you?
It really began to dawn on me very early in my career. My background was in studying the economics of R&D, and then I came to Harvard Business School and was teaching a manufacturing course. So I had to learn an awful lot about manufacturing and was going into a lot of manufacturing plants at the beginning of my career back in, you know, 1988 here, writing cases, and, you know, began to see that what I had thought of as the innovation process, you know, went well beyond R&D. So it really started by firsthand observation, and then I did a lot of research, and a lot of my work has been in the biotechnology industry, and there I just kept coming across case after case of companies with really great product ideas, great, you know, potential new drugs. And then as they went into manufacturing, they couldn't manufacture, they struggled to manufacture the drug, or they had huge delays in their development lead times. And, you know, it just really started to strike me that process innovation was a hidden source of advantage for companies who wanted to innovate. And I think it really just came that way.
Now, you mentioned the biotechnology sector there, and there's another tech sector that you mentioned that you've talked about that's really captured people's imaginations, I think, is when you say that Amazon could not produce a Kindle in the United States.
Right.
Why is that, and why is that a problem?
Well, it's in the electronics industry, the supply chains have been migrating to Asia slowly since the 60s. It started when American consumer electronics companies like RCA and Magnavox decided that consumer electronics, televisions were a mature industry and they should outsource their production to Asian subcontractors, some of whom were little known at the time, but, you know, companies like Sony got their start that way. And so since then, the electronics supply chains, the locus of manufacturing, has been shifting for decades there. It started with assembly, then went to component suppliers and all the sub-assemblies. And now, really, those supply chains are centered in Asia. We have very little of that here in the United States. So if you come up with an innovative idea like an iPad or a Kindle, it's not a matter of cost, per se, of not manufacturing in the U.S. It's just simply the capabilities really aren't here for that kind of production. Now, why is that a problem? Well, it, you know, it's not a problem, as you could see, for the Kindle, because it is manufactured outside the United States or the iPad. But what concerns us is there's an awful lot of technologies that go into that, pretty sophisticated process technologies in terms of the displays and some of the enclosure technologies and even sort of the, you know, the polished aluminum and those sort of things, that If you don't have those here, then a future company, a future innovator may need access to those to be able to, you know, launch their innovation. So I think the danger is as those capabilities have moved outside the U.S., it makes it harder and harder for future companies to, you know, startup companies and others to do innovation here.
Now, I am on the record as saying that your book is practical, not partisan. But since this has become such a political topic, I did want to ask you, what do you make of the current policy prescriptions on the table for restoring the American manufacturing sector?
I think there's some good ideas on the table. There's a number of proposals that have been made by the current administration and also that are winding their way, you know, through Congress in various committees. And so first of all, I'm happy to see that kind of manufacturing is on the agenda as part of our national economic strategy. I like some of the ideas around creating these national institutes of manufacturing that are designed to spawn, you know, invest in research, basic and applied research in various kinds of manufacturing technologies, and that involve both government and the private sector in partnership. I think those kind of efforts can help lay the groundwork and the seeds for long-term manufacturing innovation and the kind of renaissance we're talking about. I've been less enthusiastic about some of the direct subsidies that the current administration followed in terms of supporting specific industries like solar, where as we know, many companies got subsidies or tax breaks. And I think where you get to government trying to pick specific companies or very specific technologies, that is a very tough thing for governments to do right. It's a very tough thing for private venture capitalists to do right, and government is not in a good position to do that. So I think what I have liked is the spirit of trying to invest in our manufacturing infrastructure and capabilities. I think when the government leaves it at that level, it's a great thing to do. Once government tries to go beyond that and intervene in specific technology, specific companies, I think that kind of industrial policy has shown itself through history, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, to not be very effective.
And there's another sort of topic that comes up often talking about this, where people worry about the specter of protectionism. What do you make of that?
I agree. I think it's too easy to use if you read our book, and we are very clear that we are all for open trading and we're globalists. We are completely against protectionism, yet it is way too easy for many to misinterpret the argument, or I shouldn't say it's too easy. Hopefully we've written the book in a way that it's not easy, but still it doesn't stop some from saying, well, the only way to restore manufacturing in the U.S. is to build barriers. And that just does not work. It doesn't do the U.S. economy any good at all. You know, competition, global competition, is a great thing to increase every country's game. And if you want to see the negative effects of protectionism and closing yourself off from the rest of the world, just go back to Eastern Europe, you know, a few decades ago before the fall of the Iron Curtain. It was essentially closed off from the rest of the world's economy, and it was, you know, completely economically undeveloped. You had people with, you know, training in computer science who were sweeping streets. Once Eastern Europe began to open up to the rest of the world, their economies have, by and large, thrived. There's been ups and downs, but it's really important to be pushing for open trade. So we think part of government policy should be to, where other countries are erecting barriers, to be working very hard to bring those down, to create as many free trade agreements as we can. The U.S. tends to run surpluses with countries it has free trade agreements with. So we're all for free trade. And the last thing on earth we would want is for our book to be read as some excuse for creating protectionism. We're really against that.
And one of the counterexamples that often comes up here, especially with regard to the solar industry, is that manufacturers in China do get so much help from their government that it's not really, some would say, a level playing field. So how do you take down those barriers in our environment, but then still compete with competitors in a country like China?
Well, I think we've seen, in fact, just recently, there were rulings to impose some measures against the Chinese solar panel producers. So I think we have to be aggressive in fighting back. Where we see things which break international trade laws, and they're pretty clear about what you can and can't do. And, you know, these kind of subsidies or other forms of protectionism are against the rules. And where we see countries systematically trying to break the rules, we have to be very prepared to be aggressive in trying to fight back through the legal system. Now, at the same time, if we're going to do that, we also have to make sure our economy is open. So we can't be the ones who also erect, you know, subtle barriers and then not allow other countries in and then claim that, you know, we want open trade. So it goes both ways. But I think it's really important that when we say we're for open and free trade, we mean that. We don't mean allow some countries to get away completely with, you know, tilting the playing field completely in their direction, and then we just stand by. That's not good policy. So we do need to be aggressively pursuing these kind of trade cases where we see countries trying to break the rules.
Mm-hmm. So I'm also curious to know, we've talked a little bit about now China, Eastern Europe. I know that if we're looking for best practices from around the world, often people will hold up Germany and Japan as examples of advanced economies that still have very robust manufacturing mm-hmm. sectors. Do you see lessons there that we could learn best practices?
Well, some. And it, more on the case of Germany, there are some that we should and some we have to be careful of. I mean, first of all, Germany, the last decade has been great for Germany, and that's because they made a series of economic reforms in the late 90s to make their economy much more flexible. So in some sense, Germany offers a lot of lessons for other countries in Europe around just the power of having much more flexible labor markets. Germany's also done well because its growth in China has propelled a lot of growth in Germany because of huge demand for machine tools, which is a large German sector, and automobiles, which is another large German sector. So Germany's done well by that, and those lessons are hard to copy. But the lesson I think that is really important, I think what Germany has done very well that we need to do a much better job here, is training. And it's this post-secondary training for technical or vocational training that goes beyond high school that is quite specialized and that creates a manufacturing workforce that is quite technically skilled. We have tended not to do that. So in America, we have tended to, you know, focus, I think, you know, greatly on, and I admire it, on higher education, university education. But for those who don't go on to university, our training options have been somewhat limited. And I think that's because in the past, manufacturing in the U.S. really served the role for people who did not go to college. They could get a job in a factory, a pretty well-paying job, I'm talking decades ago, and lead a pretty good, you know, middle-class life. What has happened now is because of the changes in the nature of manufacturing and changes in global competition, America can only compete in the most skill-intensive, complex part of manufacturing. That requires a very skilled workforce. And that requires, you know, a lot more investment in training. And I think the Germans have done a very good job of that through their apprentice systems and other kinds of investments in the kind of post-high school education that provides deeper technical skills. I think that's one of the key lessons. It's all about human capital. I mean, the country with the strongest human capital wins. And we have got to be investing much more in our human capital, and not just at the university level, but also for the bright kids who don't necessarily, you know, find it in their best, the best fit for them to go off to a university. We still have to make sure they have great skills so they can be working in more complex jobs that the economy requires.
I'm glad you brought up this issue of jobs and wages and skills, because I think it's really become impossible to talk about manufacturing without talking about those issues. It's often said that, you know, manufacturing produced these high wages and these good jobs and a lot of jobs. But it seems to me there was actually, it's actually slightly more complicated than that. Manufacturing did produce middle-skilled jobs, but I'm wondering if the high wages were really a function of the rise of collective bargaining and labor unions. So my question to you is, even if America can restore a healthy manufacturing sector, with the decline of the unions, should we expect those jobs to pay well, or will they pay more like what their counterparts pay around the world?
No, I think, well, certainly if you go back a few decades ago, we did have two things which propelled higher wages. So partly was, yes, unions gave bargaining power, but the reason they were able to exert that bargaining power is we had less global competition. So a union could, in the 60s, negotiate for pay increases that a company could afford to, you know, agree to because it could raise its prices, because it didn't face competitors from around the world. Now, you know, American workers have to realize they face, it's not just the companies who face competitors from around the world, they themselves face competitors around the world. So I think that even if unions were stronger, we had more unions, their ability to bargain for high wages are limited by global markets. So what's the answer? How does the American workforce maintain high wages and not have them gravitate down to the low levels that you see elsewhere? Because that's a losing strategy. The name of the game there is productivity. We have to increase productivity. That's how we're going to preserve wages in America. So I think if somebody said the answer is just, gosh, if unions were stronger, we'd be great. It's like, no, without strong gains in productivity, there's no basis to gain higher wages. And so the message that I have about the long-term growth in wages, it's got to be about increasing the productivity of the American workforce. And that goes back to investing in, you know, training and skills and technology. And we've got to be in a position where we can, and when I say we, the American worker can be competing for the kind of work that can't be done elsewhere or that is too complex to be done elsewhere. And I think that's what will drive real wage growth in the U.S.
Gary Pisano, thanks so much for joining us
today. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That was Harvard Business School's Gary Pisano. His book with HBS Professor Willie Shi is Producing Prosperity, Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. For more, visit hbr.org.